Today's broadcast was originally recorded on December 10th, 2024.
Over the last decade and a half, we've seen 1,800 newspapers disappear off the landscape of the U.S. It means the rise of news deserts, where in which residents in communities, hundreds of communities, even thousands in this country, have very limited access to the sort of news and information that's been the lifeblood of our democracy.
Oh. Well, that may explain a few things. Let's discuss it, shall we?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right. I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Not scared.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
Maybe a little.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Oh, hey. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another thrilling edition of the Bradcast. Coming up in a bit, a new report from the DOJ's Inspector General might explain why Donald Trump's nominee to head the FBI, Kash Patel, is so mad at everyone. Except for the people that he should be mad at. Hint, the call is coming from inside the house, Desi Doyen.
Well, isn't it always these days?
There's also a climate change-fueled wildfire raging right now as we go to air out in Malibu, threatening thousands of homes and structures and students at Pepperdine University, and causing my beloved Dick Van Dyke, who turns 99 on Friday, to have to evacuate his home. Now I'm really mad at climate change.
Yeah.
And speaking of, Desi Doyen, you will join us for our latest Green News report in a little bit with, as usual, nothing but good news there. But I want to start with my guest today. There has been much hand-wringing from all quarters of the left and the Democratic Party over Kamala Harris's stunning reported loss to Donald Trump on November 5th, and attempts to understand it, make sense of it, blame people or political positions for it. And nonetheless, we keep coming back again and again on this program to the failure of the media, corporate media, social media, even independent media, to have adequately fulfilled their constitutionally mandated and protected role of informing the electorate about the candidates and the stakes of this election. Now, one aspect of that, in addition to the poison and lies fed to so many Americans via right-wing misinformation and disinformation on social media and of corporate media's too often obsessed with both-sidesing every issue, adding so-called balance to a decidedly unbalanced set of facts. In addition to that is the lack of and or disappearance of local news reporting that adds actual local context to the national media coverage and to the partisan positioning of the national parties. As Zach Metzger, director of the Local News Initiative Project at Northwestern University's Medill Journalism School, reports at the top of the group's State of Local News report for 2024, Quote, since 2005, more than 3,200 print newspapers have vanished. Newspapers continue to disappear at a rate of more than two per week in the past year alone. 130 newspapers have shut their doors. In addition to these closures and mergers, papers are reducing their print coverage, including shifting from dailies to weeklies or ending print publication altogether. In our 2022 report, Metzger notes the State of Local News Project predicted that by the end of 2025, the U.S. would have lost one-third of its print newspapers over the past two decades. In this year's report, he says, we find that the country has already exceeded that mark. A little fewer than 5,600 newspapers remain, 80% of which are just weeklies. As news organizations continue to contract, the report finds news deserts, areas that lack consistent local reporting that fills critical information needs, continue to expand. They find that there are now 206 counties across the country without any local news source, and 1,561 counties with just one source. Altogether, they write, this means that almost 55 million people in the U.S. have limited to no access to local news. What, if any, role did that play in the ultimate results of this year's elections? Well, journalists Paul Farhi and John Volk looked at exactly that, also on behalf of the Medill School's Local News Project, finding some alarming statistics. Donald Trump, they write, won the 2024 election with one of the smallest popular vote margins in U.S. history. But in news deserts, counties lacking a professional source of local news, it was an avalanche. Trump won 91% of these counties over his Democratic rival, Kamala Harris, according to an analysis of voting data by the Medill Journalism School's State of Local News Project. While Trump's national popular vote margin was just under a very slim 1.5%, his margin in news deserts was massive. He won those counties by an average of 54 percentage points. In the few that were won by Harris, her margin was a comparatively slim 18 points, the analysis shows. The findings are based on results from 193 of the 206 counties that the study identified as news deserts in states where county-level election results are currently available. The report found that the highest concentration of counties with limited access to local news were in solidly red states like Texas, Kentucky, Arkansas, Idaho, Montana, and Mississippi. But the journalists warn, in quoting Stephen Waldman, the president and founder of the nonprofit Rebuild Local News Organization, quote, the wrong way to interpret this is, oh, the rubes voted for Trump because they're uninformed. Okay? So if that's the wrong way to interpret this, what is the right way? Joining us now to answer that question and many more that I have about all of this is Paul Farhi, Washington Post longtime now former media reporter who left the paper at the end of 2023 after nearly 36 years as a staff writer there, during which he also covered business, politics, and general assignment features. He's also been a senior contributing editor to the American Journalism Review. He now contributes to The Atlantic, The Athletic, The Daily Beast, The Columbia Journalism Review, as well as being a contributor to the Local News Initiative at Northwestern University. Paul Farhi, delighted to have you with us on the broadcast today, sir.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So before we get into the sort of the politics of all of this, just to get our terms straight, how does this report define a local news desert, and what is either their or your explanation for the alarming and continuing decline of local news across the country?
Well, it's pretty simple. A news desert is a place, a county, you can reduce it to that jurisdiction, that doesn't have a professional source of news. There's no reporter, there's no news organization, TV, radio, print, digital, what have you, not even maybe even a blog. There are, as you pointed out in your introduction, about 206 counties like this in America. There are a number of counties, mm-hmm. as you also pointed out, that have only one professional source of information, and those are under some economic pressure as well. You might have a local newspaper, a weekly newspaper in these places, but often it's poorly staffed and it's been cut back over the years. Not a great source of local information, but some source of information. Why is this happening? Well, this has been happening for a long time. And the simple answer is the internet. The internet created enormous competition, both for readers and for advertising. And you have a duopoly now that dominates the advertising market online. That's Google and mm-hmm. Facebook. And all of that has drawn away from the economic vitality of the legacy media. It's hard to sustain a local publication when your advertisers have gone to Facebook or have mm-hmm. gone to Google. When your readers are distracted or finding alternative sources via social media, via national media, what have you. So it's a number of things, but in some sense, it's quite a simple story. Mm-hmm. The economic wave has crashed and is continuing to crash.
And it's interesting that certainly an argument could be made here that it is not just the people in those local news deserts who are paying the price, but you know, as they vote, it, of course, affects the national results. Perhaps all of us pay a price. But as noted in my intro, you report that the report found that the highest concentration of these counties was with limited access to local news were in very red states: Texas, Kentucky, Arkansas, Idaho, Montana, and Mississippi. And that Steve Waldman of the Rebuild Local News Project says the wrong way to interpret this is that, oh, the Rubes voted for Trump because they're uninformed. So does this report find that folks voted heavily Republican due to the lack of local news? I guess it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. Or were they already inclined that way in these deeply red counties before the local news sources began to disappear?
Right. You got to get the cause and effect here.
Yeah.
The cause and effect here is that news deserts occur in certain kinds of places, that is to say, rural places, places that are poorer on average, have less education on average, are less densely populated on average across America. So if you look at a map, and I encourage people to go to Medill School's map of news deserts, mm-hmm. you'll see there in what people call contemptuously flyover country. They are in very rural places. So that's one element of it. But the cause and effect question is very interesting. It is not that news deserts don't have access to an event as big as a presidential election. They mm-hmm. have plenty of access. They've got the New York Times. They've got the Washington Post. They've got CNN, Fox News. If you've got an internet connection, you can find out lots and lots about the presidential election.
Right.
That's not an issue.
Uh-huh.
But you have to understand that local news does modify political behavior in very subtle but important ways. And we can talk a little bit about that. But the research that's emerging is basically this. If you live in a news desert, your sources are going to be national sources. The issues will be framed on a national basis entirely. CNN does not cover what's going on in the counties in Texas mm-hmm. Or Montana. It covers the national scene so that your orientation as you are consuming news about the election is going to be the national orientation. It will not be modified by what you learn from your local news sources because there are no local news sources. That is to say, if a proposal by one of the candidates, Trump, Harris, whomever, mm-hmm. Has an effect on your local community, let's say mm-hmm. it's going to be something about tariffs. Mm-hmm. We know that in our county, we import a lot of, product, a certain kind of product. that tariff information might modify your understanding of your mm-hmm. preference for a candidate. Abortion, mm-hmm. the economy, what have you. These issues have local resonance, but they don't if you have no access to understanding how they affect your local community. So what happens? Well, the research that's emerging is that people frame their choice around their partisanship. I'm a Republican. I'm going to vote Republican. I don't need any local news to mm-hmm. modify that behavior because I don't have any local news to modify that behavior. It increases the polarization yeah. and the partisanship of the electorate because they cannot weigh or have no information to weigh it against what's happening in their local community.
Fascinating. So instead of looking at the issues of note through the lens of what this means to me, they end up sort of looking at these issues through the national partisan lens, who is on my team, who is not on my team, as opposed to how these issues might affect me here at home, might affect the prices I pay at the grocery store, may affect my my employment opportunities, my rights, as you say, for reproductive rights and so forth. All of that is sort of set to the side in favor of the national, what team are you on?
I could not have said it better myself. That's exactly right. But there's two other important elements here. This goes to the lack of local news. Uh-huh. One is the question of split ticket voting. I might vote for the Republican for president or the Democrat, uh-huh. but I like the Republican or the opposite party down ballot, Senate, House, what have you, mayor. When you live in a news desert, again, the research is beginning to show you have less and less of this split ticket voting. Mm-hmm. Again, it's the same factor. I don't really have enough information about right. my local community. So therefore, I'll just stick to my partisan preference. I'm just going to vote straight Democrat or straight mm-hmm. Republican, as the case may be. And so, if you had more local information, the senator is doing a good job. He's bringing us jobs. He's bringing us infrastructure money, what have you. I might vote for him even if he's in the opposite party of my own preference. That's less and less that's happening. Mm-hmm. The second element, less studied but important and interesting, is something called ballot roll-off. Mm-hmm. I'd never heard this phrase before, but it effectively means something very simple. I don't vote for anything other than president. I leave all of those races blank. Uh-huh. I'll vote for president because I have national news sources to tell me there's an election and here are the issues in the election and here are the candidates. But I don't have a lot of information about my senator, my house race, my mayor, what have you, city council. I don't have a lot of information about those things. I'm just going to leave that blank. I know that I personally have done this, and I live in a very news-rich community, mm-hmm. In certain smaller races, because I really can't tell you a whole lot about those races. Judges, mm-hmm. Local judges, I don't really know a lot. So I've left those blank at times. Mm-hmm. Now, I could find that information with some effort, but, you in politics, inertia is a major factor.
Right.
How many people will go and research those down ballot races? So ballot roll-off, it appears, tends to increase in places where there is very little local news because mm-hmm. people just don't know and don't make the effort to know.
There are several points you covered a lot there. Let me hit a few of them because it occurs to me that if one is exposed only first to national news, if that's your only access to presidential election and so forth, that it sort of mm-hmm. reinforces your basic partisan identity views rather than, issues that actually affect you. Right. And not to both sides this, but isn't that exactly kind of what both national parties would prefer that voters do? It sort of works out great for them, doesn't it? Because they get to create the narrative about what people are voting on.
Yes, but that's almost by definition. We're the national party. We're mm-hmm. Involved in the national races. We fund them. Mm-hmm. We shape them. We pick the candidates to a certain extent in our party. That's what the national parties do. What does the state party mm-hmm. think about this? What does right. the local party okay. think about this? Yeah. They're going to be suffocating to a certain extent because they can't always get their message out. And by the way, I should add, you know, they can send mailers, they can put billboards up, they can do a lot of things that don't require media attention. But media attention is important because it's perceived as more nonpartisan, more neutral. You can argue about that, but it is more so than if you receive an advertisement. Right. And so the state and the local parties suffer as a result of the lack of local news. You know, if they stage a debate among primary candidates, how much coverage does it get? Well, in news deserts, it doesn't get any coverage because there's no one to cover it. So these are the issues that are emerging in these news deserts.
And the other point you raise is about that roll-off vote. Now, you know, there's been concerns about the accuracy of the reported results this year by folks on the left who have noted a seemingly larger than usual drop-off vote, as they call it. You describe it roll-off. Other people call it bullet ballot if it's got just one vote and, you know, no votes for anything else.
Same idea.
Yeah. So do you have any sense if how or if the local news deserts might be increasing that particular phenomenon in America? We're seeing, we saw a lot of it this year, but is there a correlation with the local news deserts? Are we seeing an increase along with the number of papers and so forth that are shutting down in those areas?
Yeah, this is the least studied of the news desert elements. There's a few other things we can talk about, but this one is the one that the academic scholars of this phenomenon have not looked into. This, they suspect, in talking with them, they suspect that it increases in news desert counties, that you know, you'll see a higher percentage. One scholar I talked to said it might even explain the difference in certain Senate races where one candidate, you know, won by a couple percentage points. How much of that was people not voting in that election because, again, of this roll-off phenomenon, that they didn't have enough information, didn't feel comfortable even rendering a judgment, or they just went with straight partisanship without thinking about it too much. So this bears greater study is the unfortunate answer to that.
Well, it's interesting, though, because it's somewhat ironic here that, you know, you've got folks on the left who are looking at the results saying, huh, there seems to be this huge drop off. Number of drop-off votes that we haven't necessarily seen in the past. But in another sense, in that case, it was actually Republicans who ended up paying the price for that drop-off, because it was Democratic senators and members of the House in particular
entirely
who did
possible.
Better than might be expected when people voted, you know, Republican for president and then didn't vote in the rest of them. The Republicans could be the victims here, no?
Let's be clear that news deserts don't just occur in places that are dominated by Republicans. They tend to be in places dominated by Republicans, but there are counties in, you know, in the South, for instance, that have a majority or a large percentage of African-American population that tends to vote Democratic. That's a news desert, too. And whatever effect that has on the national and local races is just the same as it's going to be in a very red state. So it's not a one-size-fits-all phenomenon by any means.
It's not, but there are a lot of victims, and that you cite another interesting point from Stephen Waldman of Rebuild Local News, that Republicans in these local news deserts are ultimately the most common victims, not the only ones, of the collapse of local news. How so? And this is aside from the political winning and losing elections, but just on a local level, they become victims.
Yeah, well, these results expose the fact that the disproportionate effects of news deserts are occurring in places where people vote Republican or vote Trump. It's a certain kind of irony insofar as those people are the ones who have the most resentment of the media, because that's been a theme of Trump's for the last 10 years or so. And, you know, the effects of news deserts, let's take it out of the political context and just talk about the effects of news deserts. What happens? Well, in news deserts, because you don't have a watchdog, you have more political corruption on average. You have higher taxes on average. You have lower bond ratings. You have a certain kind of social alienation and loss of, you know, community because no one's covering the high school sports or the obits or the community events or the things that, you know, are not major stories, but they kind of give a community some cohesion and coherence and common knowledge. So those things, when they disappear, which they do in news deserts, are disproportionately affecting Trump voters. And Trump voters are the very ones, as Stephen Waldman told me, who should be working, you know, to do something about this phenomenon, because they're the victims of it. You can resent the Washington Post or the New York Times all you want, but, you know, all politics is local and all news deserts are local, and your community is the one that's being hurt by the loss of media, no matter what you think of the media itself.
Yeah.
It's not a good thing.
No, it is not. And I want to sort of underscore that point that you cite from Waldman. He concluded that so-called conservative voters, the very ones that Trump has targeted with his attacks on the press, quote, should be helping to lead the drive to save local news.
And you know, I think if you ask those people, honestly, they would say, oh, no, I did like my local paper because, you know, those people are part of my community. They understand my issues. You know, I may even have directly engaged with them. When people talk about, quote unquote, the media, a very, very imprecise term, they mean something very remote and distant. They mean the New York Times, they mean the CNN, Fox News, what have you. What is the likelihood that anyone in, say, rural Texas or Montana or elsewhere is going to interact with a reporter from CNN or Fox News or the Washington Post? It's very, very low. This is an observation about human behavior more than anything. If you ask people about local conditions relative to national conditions, they'll tell you, well, things locally are actually pretty good. Yeah. I like my local schools, for instance. Mm-hmm. You know, I know the principal, I know the teachers, my kids went there, they had a good experience in going. If you ask them about education generally, they'll say, oh, my goodness, no, it's terrible. I know it's terrible. Yes. So it's the same way with media. You know, I used to like the local reporters or the local paper. I'm sorry, they're gone. But, oh, no, I hate the media because the media is that partisan thing abstractly from a distance.
And it is interesting. We have seen that for years, even before this phenomenon of the newspapers going out. We've seen that phenomenon over the years where, you know, America always hates Congress. They always have, you know, terrible low
That's
scores, throw all the bums out, except for my bum. He's doing a great job. And then the Americans vote over and over again for the incumbents.
90%+ of the time. That's
It's amazing. That's right. Paul Farhi, before you go, I sort of have to ask you, given your decades at the Washington Post formerly, what do we make of what is now going on at the Post with its billionaire owner, Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, and his decision to spike the endorsement of Kamala Harris right before the election? Can we trust Washington Post as a news source in the second Trump era at this point? Do you trust Washington Post?
You've got two different questions there.
Okay.
First of all, Jeff Bezos's actions in terms of not in spiking that endorsement 11 days before the election was a self-inflicted wound. It's obvious that it was. 250,000 subscribers canceled their subscriptions, apparently as a result of that decision. Yep. That is a phenomenal, terrible outcome. And I'm very sorry to see it. You know, we worked very hard to attract those people by our good work or work we thought was good. And to lose them in a week or two as a result of one decision or non-decision, as it turns out, is just a tragedy to all of us who have something to do with the Post. This next question is, can you trust the Washington Post? You most certainly can. It's one of the best news sources in America. Jeff Bezos has actually been a very good owner of the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. And the reason I say that is because he gave the Washington Post a lot of money to do journalism. It takes a lot of money to do journalism. He has a lot of money and he gave it to us. And secondly, he didn't tell us what to do with that money specifically, at least for the most part. He didn't say, go cover, you know, this subject or that subject. We know what to do if we have the resources to do it. And so this is, to my mind, you know, it's a bit of a misnomer to say because he decided not to create an have an endorsement of the president, which, by the way, no one would care what the Washington Post really says about who it thinks should be president. That's an editorial decision. It has nothing to do, and people don't get this, it has nothing to do with the way the newsroom covers any topic. Okay. The editorial side is separate, almost physically separate, but certainly as an editorial question, separate from the news side. And those two things operate under different leadership and in different fashion. So anyway, the whole thing was, you know, a fiasco and a tragedy,
yeah.
I'm afraid.
Well, and I guess I lied. One more question along these lines.
Sure.
In the what is sort of becoming an internal debate right now, should folks cancel their subscriptions over something like that, whether it's, you know, Washington Post or anywhere else, or not cancel the subscriptions to keep funding the journalism that we so desperately need in this country?
Exactly. I mean, it's the latter. You know, it was so unfortunate that people vented their fury, and I guess they were very upset about this, by canceling, because who does that hurt? It hurts Jeff Bezos to some extent. Although he's still going to be one of the richest guys in the world, he's not going to be too bad off. Mm-hmm. But it's going to hurt the newsroom because the Post was losing money. And the reason I'm no longer there is because they reduced their staff through buyouts. I took one of those buyouts and left with about 10% of the staff. And, you know, you're just impairing the overall enterprise and its ability to function by canceling your subscription and taking away your dollars. And, you know, if you want a lesser Washington Post, you'll undoubtedly get it by that by that action. And by the way, it's not going to change his mind either. This is apparently his permanent view, as well as the view of the owner of the Los Angeles Times, who did the same thing 2 days before Jeff Bezos did. I'd argue that it was really a question of timing, not a question of decision. You know, here we are at the last few days of the presidential campaign, and you come up with this decision. You should have done it 6 months, a year, 2 years before or after the election, not in the heat of the election and the campaign. But nevertheless, it's, you know, it's something they have to deal with. And again, I get that people are upset, but by canceling, you've hurt the very thing that you apparently valued before you canceled, which was good journalism. And I still think we do. The Post still does a lot of good journalism.
I gotcha. I concur with you. I think I go along with your opinion here, although I certainly do understand people wanting to send a message that this is not okay to these folks. Paul Farhi, the former media reporter from The Washington Post for many, many years. Now you can find him at places like The Atlantic and at Northwestern University's Metal School of Journalism, writing on this important issue of local news deserts. You can also find him, I'm happy to say, not only over at the site still known as Twitter, where he is far hip, we'll say. You can now find him also at Blue Sky, where he is the same username, Fari P, or just Far Hip. I think that's the easier way to remember it, Paul. Really appreciate you joining us today, sir. I hope to speak to you about all of this again in the near future. I suspect we'll have reasons to do so in the years ahead.
Anytime, Brad. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Paul. All right, let's take a quick break, and we will come back with some news on why Kash Patel is so mad about everything.
Okay.
Maybe. And, well, more. Desi Doyen's Green News Report and a fire in Malibu and everything else. All that straight ahead on today's Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At The Bradcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of The Bradcast. Welcome back. It's The Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. So we talked a bit on yesterday's program about Kash Patel, the Trump stooge and MAGA merchandiser who Donald Trump has said he intends to nominate as FBI director, even though Trump's own previous appointment to lead the FBI, Christopher Wray, who replaced James Comey after Trump fired him for not being willing to be enough of a lackey. Is that a good way to put it?
Yes, it is.
Christopher Wray still has 3 years left on his term. But okay, Trump can fire him as well, apparently, and try to have Patel take his place after Cash has vowed to weaponize federal law enforcement in a second Trump administration to investigate and prosecute and even jail Trump's perceived domestic enemies in Congress, in federal agencies, and of course, in the media. Patel even included a list of some 60 people by name in his book that he calls government gangsters that he believes should be prosecuted. The list includes Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, Hillary Clinton, now Senator Adam Schiff, senator as of Monday, to people like Cassidy Hutchinson, the former deputy to Trump's chief of staff who testified about Trump's behavior on January 6th to the January 6th committee, Obama's attorney general, Eric Holder, Biden's attorney general, Merrick Garland, former FBI director Robert Mueller. These are all people that Cash wants to target. Trump's own FBI director, Christopher Wray, who Patel would theoretically replace. He wants to target him. Trump's own joint chiefs of staff at the Pentagon, General Mark Milley. Trump's own attorney general, Bill Barr, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Doesn't matter if you didn't do anything illegal.
Lock
them
up.
After them anyway.
Lock them all up. And on Sunday, by the way, Trump himself indicated that he was all on board with this. He called for the jailing of former Republican Congresswoman Liz Cheney, current Democratic Rep Benny Thompson, and all of the other members of the January 6th committee. They all got to go to jail. You get the idea. Well, today, perhaps we've got a little bit more insight as to why Kash Patel may be so interested in jailing at least some of these folks, even if they, as you note, do not appear to have, you know, broken any actual laws,
yep,
per se. But some of them did go after Patel, sort of, and they did so during the first Trump administration. And they happen to be people who worked for Donald Trump. As CNN describes it today, the Justice Department secretly obtained phone records from two members of Congress and 43 staffers, including Kash Patel, Donald Trump's pick to lead the FBI, during sweeping leak investigations during Donald Trump's first term. According to a watchdog report released on Tuesday. So, but let me just underscore that, because CNN didn't. Donald Trump's own Department of Justice secretly obtained phone records from members of Congress and from 43 congressional staffers, which included Kash Patel at the time, because he was a staffer for then Congressman Devin Nunes, as part of a probe into leaks to journalists from members of Congress and or their staffers. So if anyone did Patel wrong, it was Trump's own people, essentially, it seems to me. But of course, this report is perhaps most disturbing, at least to me, because it raises concerns, as CNN notes, about how the department tried to root out reporters' sources from a sprawling and bipartisan list of federal employees who had access to classified information simply because of their job. Patel and the two members of Congress are not named specifically in the report, but two sources familiar with the matter tell CNN that Patel was targeted along with Democratic Reps Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell and other congressional staffers. Patel was a staffer for the GOP-led House Intelligence Committee at the time, and Schiff has since been elected to the Senate. And by the way, he was sworn into office early on Monday as he takes the seat that was officially vacated following the death of Dianne Feinstein out here in California. Prosecutors also secretly sought records, including emails from journalists at CNN, at the Washington Post, at the New York Times. And that really bothers me. As NBC characterizes the IG's report on its investigation of leaks of classified information, the Trump Justice Department in 2017-2018 secretly obtained phone and text message logs of 43 congressional staffers and two members of Congress in a far broader probe than was previously known. The report by Inspector General Michael Horowitz found that the DOJ did not act with political motives, okay, but failed to take sufficient account of constitutional separation of powers by seizing communication records of staffers and lawmakers and making them subjects of a criminal investigation only because they had lawful access to state secrets through their jobs. In other words, they didn't have any evidence that these people had committed a crime. That's one thing where you have the executive branch actually looking into the congressional branch.
Right.
Crossing over that, you know, so-called separation of powers because they suspect a crime was carried out by a certain person. That's not what happened here. What happened here was, well, they were on the committee where certain, you know, information that somehow leaked to the media had come out. They were on that committee. So let's investigate them. They had access to that information because of their job. So let's go after them. Let's spy on them. That is what they actually literally did, was spy on them.
It's cute that CNN says that, oh, the probe failed to account for constitutional concerns. Maybe they didn't fail to account for that. They totally knew about it, did it anyway.
Didn't care. Prosecutors obtained the records using subpoenas and other then legal processes to third-party providers like Apple and Google, and attached gag orders to prevent the companies from notifying the customers. So in other words, they contacted Apple or Google, said, we need this information, and you are not to tell the people whose information we are taking. The fact of the seizures had been previously reported, but the IG revealed new details about the broad scope of the effort. Separately, the IG report released Tuesday found that the Trump Justice Department violated its own policies in the way that it secretly obtained phone and text records from reporters in this same leak investigations, in these same leak investigations, I should say, because there was about three or four different, completely different things that they were, that the Trump administration was mad about and that they were trying to investigate to figure out who did it. But the secretly obtained information related to the FBI's probe of suspected Trump campaign coordination with Russia, for example. Oh, they didn't like that. The seizures of the records from reporters from the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN had previously been reported, and the Biden Justice Department stiffened the guidelines on the issue once he took office after the guidelines had previously been updated during the Obama administration in 2014 and 2015, but apparently were easily worked around once Trump took over the DOJ. although then Attorney General Bill Barr personally approved the news media subpoenas in 2020, a committee that had been set up to review any such moves was not consulted, as the policy at the time required, according to the report. Barr, of course, refused to cooperate with the IG's inquiry. The records obtained included phone and message logs showing who was communicating with whom, but not the content of the communication. So they didn't see what was actually written, if a Congress member or staff member had talked with a journalist, but they were able to see that, yeah, they contacted someone at the New York Times or CNN, Washington Post, and so forth. Two California Democrats that the Trump administration essentially spied on, now Senator Adam Schiff, who was chair of the House Intel Committee, and Congressman Eric Swalwell, who was a member of that committee. They had previously acknowledged that they were targeted by these record seizures. The leak investigations did not result in criminal charges at the time, but given the 10-year statute of limitations for some of the alleged crimes, they could be reopened by the new administration. Perhaps Cash, if he becomes the FBI director, could investigate the leaks to himself or by himself. Maybe he could throw himself in jail. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, described the revelations in the report as, quote, beyond disturbing. He said, as these abuses demonstrate, there are few guardrails preventing a lone prosecutor or the Attorney General, the Department of Justice, from spying on Congress and threatening our constitutional system of checks and balances. The person Trump says he wants to make FBI director, Cash Patel, has specifically vowed to go after reporters. Though it seems to me, at least based on this report, that his ire may be somewhat misguided here. It seems he should be angry at, Donald Trump and his own administration for spying on him. Am I out of bounds here? As CNN describes it, the leak investigation years ago swept up Patel's Google account information. Last fall, Patel sued Trump's prior top DOJ and FBI appointees, including FBI Director Christopher Wray, for unfairly obtaining his data in 2017. Now, remind me, who was president in 2017? I know it'll come to me soon. Anyway, apparently they were able to obtain his Google and Google Voice records. In his complaint, he says he learned 5 years after the subpoena that the DOJ had sought that communication. Google told him only in December of 22 that it had, quote, received and responded to a legal process by the U.S. Department of Justice compelling the release of information related to your Google account. That notification from Google to Patel made public in the lawsuit and said, quote, a court order previously prohibited Google from notifying you of the legal process. We are now permitted to discuss the receipt of that legal process to you. That, I believe, is thanks to those changes to the policies that were made during the Biden administration. So you're welcome, Cash. The underlying court records aren't publicly available. Patel wasn't provided with additional details about what was driving the investigation into him. That's typical for these type of pursuits. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. ultimately dismissed Patel's lawsuit this fall. The judge said that said the officials that Patel sued were actually immune and that Patel hadn't argued successfully that he was actually harmed by the official's work. Now, of course, he wants to become the FBI director so he can try to throw them all in jail. That said, it sure seems to me that someone should go to jail for attempting to spy, if not on members of Congress, then members of the media. But maybe that's just me. Patel, on the other hand, he wants to toss the media in jail for, I don't know, something or other.
We will go out and find the conspirators, not just in government, but in the media. Yes, we're going to come after the people in the media who lied about American citizens, who helped Joe Biden rig presidential elections. We're going to come after you. Whether it's criminally or civilly, we'll figure that out. But yeah, we're putting you all on notice. And this is why they hate us. This is why we're tyrannical. This is why we're dictators.
Actually, no, we hate you for a whole bunch of reasons, Cash. The most of them stem from you being an absolute idiot. By the way, someone may have done him wrong, but it wasn't the Biden administration or the media, as far as I could tell. The call, as the AG's report shows again today, was coming from inside the house of the Trump administration, you jackass. Green News Report is next. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. My thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help Desi Doyen and I stay on your public airwaves. You're the only one that keeps us here. Thank you. All right, as usual, I'm running a bit long, yes. But I just want to note thousands of California residents were under evacuation orders and warnings on Tuesday as firefighters battle a wind-driven fire in Malibu that burned near celebrities' seaside mansions, horse farms, and Pepperdine University, where students watched as flames raced down hillsides and the sky turned deep red. That's not far from us here, but we are in no danger.
Yes.
The more than 8,100 homes and other structures are under threat, including more than 2,000 where residents were ordered to evacuate. Another 6,000 people were warned to be prepared to flee at a moment's notice as Santa Ana winds, with gusts reaching 40 miles per hour, made for erratic fire conditions on a day when the National Weather Service had issued a red flag warning last night that I was reading about, with the special added, quote, particularly dangerous situation label added to it. Anyway, hope everyone's okay there. The report notes that Dick Van Dyke, one of many celebrities with homes in Malibu, said that he and his wife had evacuated as the fire swept in. The actor turns 99 on Friday. Happy birthday. And now, our latest Green News Report.
It is very clear that if we don't tackle climate change internationally, these impacts will get worse over our lifetimes.
UK and Ireland hit with deadly, ferocious back-to-back storms. China's electric vehicle boom is eroding global oil demand.
Good.
Plus,
we're going to be ending a lot of the environmental things that were ridiculous.
Time is running out to cash in on Biden's climate law incentives.
Not so good. All of those stories and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I think we talk a lot about the costs of tackling climate change. What we have rarely talked about in the, 16 or so years I've been working is the costs of not tackling climate change.
Well, that's funny. We've been talking about exactly that for at least 6 minutes, at least twice a week for the last 16 years. Hi, this is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, there is so much going on at once, I don't even think I noticed what was going on in the UK.
Yeah, sadly, a massive winter storm slammed into the UK and Ireland over the weekend with hurricane-force winds fueled by record-warm Atlantic Ocean waters. Storm Dara killed at least two, knocked out power to hundreds of thousands amid frigid temperatures, and canceled flights, trains, and a major football event. Just 2 weeks after getting slammed by deadly and destructive Storm Bert. UK climate chief Emma Pinchbeck on Sky News warned that Britain is not moving fast enough to build resilient infrastructure and protect its economy from increasingly frequent extreme storms and intense heat waves.
Emma Pinchbeck?
Yes.
We have to prepare for it. We have to prepare our infrastructure for it. We have to prepare the economy for it. We have to prepare homes for it. We're off track against where we should be.
In other news, OPEC Plus members late last week delayed plans to start boosting their output as the oil cartel, led by Saudi Arabia and Russia, continues to struggle with weak demand growth. Bloomberg News reports part of that is due to electric vehicles, with China's boom in EV ownership seriously eroding demand for imported oil and gas.
Nice.
China's sales of EVs and hybrids have hit a tipping point, now accounting for more than half of retail passenger vehicle sales.
Nice.
The International Energy Agency projects that the global surge in renewable energy and EVs will continue to eat away at global demand for oil. But the agency warns that plastic, which is made from oil, will be the primary driver of oil demand in the near-term future.
The oil companies always win, don't they?
Relatedly, a new comprehensive survey reveals a significant shift in global automotive preferences. Nearly 60% of drivers worldwide say they expect to own an electric vehicle within the next 10 years. China has grabbed more than 75% of the global EV market as of October, according to industry officials, even though Chinese EVs are all but blocked from the U.S.
Man, we are going to screw this up, aren't we?
Here in the U.S., the Department of Energy is racing to move federal funding for clean energy projects out the door before Donald Trump returns to the White House in January when he vows to end the program. The department is hustling to finalize loans from its $400 billion lending program, which has backed projects in every state, including electric car and battery factories across the nation, reopening a shuttered nuclear reactor in Michigan, expanding rooftop solar in Puerto Rico, and more. Years ago, that same loan program helped Elon Musk's Tesla survive a rough patch, but Republicans' Project 2025 has targeted the program for elimination.
Pulling up the ladder.
Finally, if you're thinking of buying an electric car, an energy-saving heat pump, or energy efficiency upgrades that are eligible for federal tax credits and rebates, now is the time, experts say, before the incoming Trump administration rescinds them. The rebates are funded by President Biden's landmark climate law, the Inflation Reduction Act, which includes more than $8.5 billion in incentives for American households to decarbonize their lives and upgrade the energy efficiency of their homes. On NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday, Trump promised that on day one, he would immediately cancel the $7,500 tax credit toward the purchase of an electric vehicle that saves consumers money but erodes consumer demand for oil and gas.
So we're going to end the electric mandate immediately for the cars. It's ridiculous. We're going to be ending a lot of the environmental things that were ridiculous, that hurt our country very badly and didn't do anything for the environment. So we'll be doing, you know, standard things.
Oh, yeah, standard things. By the way, there is no EV mandate. But sure, government efficiency demands we pull back incentives that go to the American people so that we can have more money go to the billionaires, like Elon Musk. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the social medias, now including Blue Sky at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report. Get it while the getting is good.
Yep, get on that now.
Thank you very much, Desi Doyen. Thanks to our guest today, journalist Paul Farhi. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show or any other, you can always download them all for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible thanks to those of you who hit a donate button when you're there or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, including Blue Sky, you will find me at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Till we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.